start here. My guest for today is John Robb. Hey, John, nice having you on the show.
Thanks, Robert.
So you have a new book out. It's called The American Way, The Lost Secret to American Prosperity and How to Get It Back. Before we get to the book, I'd like to get some information on your background. I know you were in military intelligence.
Well, I wasn't actually in military intelligence. I was an operator. I was a pilot, and I work in special ops.
And you're also known.
So,
yeah. And what are some of the...
Go ahead.
Tell us about some of your experiences and your works in special ops and in counterterrorism that influenced... How did it influence your work?
Well, it just gave me a unique perspective. I mean, I had experiences all around the world, and I saw things up close and personal and how things work in practice. And what led me to focus in on conflict-related issues was, you know, I saw a big disparity between the kind of analysis that was going on, about Iraq, about terrorism, in the popular press and, coming out of the DOD and out of the White House, the disparity between that and what was actually happening. So, I combined my experience with, out in the field as an operator, with my time as a technology analyst at Forrester and other places, and I came up with a book called Brave New War in 2007 that seemed to be pretty popular, about how war was operating on an open source level and moving towards disruption versus kind of blood and guts terrorism, working in a very decentralized way where lots of small groups and individuals can come together and share information to achieve a greater outcome. I detailed all the ins and outs and how that worked in practice, and it's proven correct again and again. There was even an article in Nature magazine, the premier scientific magazine, I think, in the world right now, and that was focused in exclusively on some of the dynamics that went on in open source warfare, and I was a peer reviewer for the article, which was kind of cool to see, scientists actually looking at it as a methodology to be studied. So my recent work, though, was looking at that same kind of disparity between what people thought the U.S. was about and what I saw the U.S. as about, what I thought actually was true about America on the ground at a personal level.
So what did you expect before you got into the military? What was your sort of general concept of the role of foreign policy and the role that America plays in the world?
Well, being younger, you don't really have a well-formed view of how things work until you get out into the world and it develops. I do think, though, that, looking back, that a lot of the excesses that people can, attribute to the United States occurred almost exclusively after World War II, in terms of, foreign policy and things it did outside the borders of the United States. And that had largely to do with the fact that it was fighting a Cold War and that it was acting as a kind of the leader or the kind of owner of one side in that conflict. And that's, very unnatural for the United States. And, we're very much focused typically on just on ourselves and, you know, and becoming prosperous and improving the quality of life for the people around us, and not, you know, empire builders. It's just not us. And that, you know, somehow we were convinced that that was the thing to do.
And this was...
And we spend a lot of money and spend a lot of blood doing it.
This was from about 86 to 92?
Well, everything after World War II. You know, you can almost see it. You know, what my book did is, that, you know, I went back and looked at our economic performance because I thought something, you know, was key there. And what I found was that there was something really special about the U.S., something that I hadn't heard explained in by economists. I hadn't, you know, seen written up by anybody else. You know, what the U.S. was able to do from the moment it was founded, we had a, you know, per capita income that was less than China in 1776, and we're much less than Europe and all the powers, the great powers in Europe. And by 1800, we had passed them all, and we kept on passing, you know, on a per person income level, we just zoomed past everybody, and kept on going all the way up till World War II. Even through the Great Depression, we were accelerating ahead of everybody else. And then I went back and tried to figure out what was the reason for that. You know, why did it then tail off after World War II? And what I found was that there was a very strong dynamic at work, a kind of a secret formula, kind of a cultural formula that the U.S. had put in place in terms of how it ran its economy that was different than everybody else's. And it allowed us again and again and again to invent the future economy, the next economy, by inventing the kind of technological advances that, in a way, that actually everybody could use. We led in electrification. We led in, automobiles, for instance, with Ford. You know, for all his faults on the political side, what he saw early on was that the American consumer, the American household, the family, needed low-cost transportation. And he, you know, fought with his investors again and again. He even collapsed his first company over a dispute over the type of car that they would be, you know, he wanted to produce. They wanted him to go after a luxury car, and he wanted to produce a car that everybody could use. And eventually he was able to get that out. And when he did, you know, by 1916, we were selling more, Ford alone was selling more cars than every other manufacturer in the world combined, including U.S. And it was U.S. families were buying them in a number that was unprecedented, about 500 to 600,000 a year. Now, far, far, far more than everywhere else in the world, more than all the world combined, actually. And so you see this again and again and again in all these technologies. I mean, in telephone, in flight, even with the Wright brothers. I mean, proving actually, you know, that you could actually have powered flight, and getting to the first commercial application of that, and moving it forward in a way that made it possible for everybody to acquire. And that's a big change. It's a kind of a monumental thing to be able to create something new like that. And, you know, by taking on this kind of new role after World War II, this big bureaucratic government and this big financial system, with all of the banks and all the control that they represent, you know, changed the fundamental nature of what we were about and broke that formula. And we're slowly.
So what you're kind of getting at with this book is, this is your new book, called The American Way, The Lost Secret to American Prosperity and How to Get It Back. But this also ties in with what you've been advocating called, you have a website called Resilient Communities. So I want to get like a basic definition for audience of what a resilient community is. So basically, it's a community that is self-sufficient from the rest of the economy. Is that a good basic definition?
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm not so much focused on the prepping side, you know, the preppers. I'm focused more on and producing more locally and producing as much as you can locally, because I think the trend that we're seeing right now in technology and everything else is towards producing everything locally, local energy production, local food production, local product production. And then if you do produce products, you're sending the electronic designs for those products around the world rather than the products themselves and have them produced locally where they're being used. And that's all that 3D manufacturing stuff. So everything's going local. Yet you can actually do business global if you're doing it electronically. And that the resilient community is about creating a group of people that want to actually improve the quality of life for everybody in the community by, you know, folding in that production in a way that makes the life of the person living there much richer than it is today. Because we've lost connections to everything now. We lost connections to our food. We lost connections to our products. When you go in and buy a product at the store, it's an anonymous transaction. I mean, economics has become anonymous. It's like anonymous sex. It's not a kind of a good thing to have. It's not a good thing to do. It used to be a social interaction. When you bought something, it was a social act. It was based on trust, or mutual trust and respect, and belief in that the other person is getting value for fairness of the deal. And we've given all that up in the last, just in the last 50, 60 years. We've gone completely anonymous and, anonymous money, and the transactions are based on, generic contracts, and you don't even see the person. You don't even see the people that make stuff. So Resilient Community was about returning, to that local production, adding value, adding richness to your life. And how that, that ties in with my thinking in terms of how the, yeah, go ahead.
Are there any resilient communities in practice in the United States?
There's lots of eco villages and new developments, and people are starting to convert over from the idea of producing a planned development with a golf course, moving towards a planned development with a farm at the center, or multiple farms, orchards, actually even ponds that are stocked. But it's also happening organically when you have every place that has a makerspace is building a kind of a center for resilience. What people focus on in the mainstream press, when I was talking about resilient communities early on, a lot of people latched onto it about, disaster resilience, ability to bounce back from that. And for the most part, the people that have been focusing on that have been focusing on the idea that if you have strong community ties, like a community calling tree and network, that you can rebounce back during the bad phases of a disaster, just by helping each other, and then apply for help from the government. Go for grants, go for disaster relief, and everything will be okay. But my big problem.
When we really started to see these
that's how they did it.
Economic collapses starting with the Great Depression, it all goes back to a strong centralized economy.
Correct. Yeah, I mean the Great Depression was largely caused by the rise of big finance. It's funny. You think about World War II, and I was thinking, about the rise of big bureaucracy, big bureaucratic government, and big bureaucracies and corporations too, and big finance, how they both go hand in hand. That actually started in World War I. That the bloodiness of that war, the extreme intensity of World War I, or killed so many people and ground them up in Europe, was largely due, I think, to the unanticipated success at bureaucracies in mobilizing nations for war, that they had never seen mobilization on that scale before. They never expected to be able to field that many men. It was all in just theoretical. But the bureaucracy was able to not only draft them all, but train them, arm them, and put them into the field, and sustain them over multiple years by taking everything from the nation states and applying it. Now, that was just a complete shift And they never had the money to be able to, you know, build a bureaucracy that large, but it was largely possible because finance had gotten to a level where they could actually start to do the taxation required. So that was our first taste of that bureaucratic financial connection. And then it only grew and grew. And in World War II, it changed everything after that. And now we live in a world dominated by big finance and big bureaucracy. And, it's slowing down, it's stagnating, it's not moving forward like it should.
So does your new book, does it talk about banking solutions?
No, actually, if you start thinking about tweaking the existing systems, like lightening up on bureaucracy or lightening up on finance, or, changing the way finance works just by tweaking it, then you might miss the bigger pattern. You're arguing within the frameworks of the problem. I'm not saying that all bureaucracy is bad. I mean, governments should have some bureaucracy. It's a meritocratic kind of approach to running an administration or a management system for a nation. And finance at some level is good. But what I'm focusing on is everything in between and how we can build a new economy that works better. And fortunately, there's lots of great tech trends and that make it possible to bring back a lot of what was great about the U.S., what made it possible for the U.S., unlike so many other countries, as capable as they are, U.S. had one role in the world. It just created this new economy, created this new way of doing things that seemed to generate success for everybody.
What would you say are the main factors that are unique about America that led to that?
Yeah, I went through all the different things that could have contributed to it. And what I found is that there was this a three-part dynamic. And this core dynamic drove the way we made our economic decisions. Because, if you look at all the infrastructure and you look at the markets and you look at the legal systems and all that other stuff, that's all window dressing. The key to any kind of national or even personal success is good economic decision making done in a way that yields success on a repeated basis, and not the kind of tools you have available and not the kind of systems that you interact with. Are you following me on that one?
Yeah.
Decisions are more important than... Yep. And so what influences our decision making is how we orient our decisions, and Americans oriented their decisions in a very unique way. They based their decision making on trusted relationships. There wasn't, early on for most of the United States' history, is that we were very decentralized. Our growth outstripped our legal system. Our legal system was antiquated and very, weak in comparison to what you saw in every other country or a developed country. And the way we did conducted our economic transactions was based on trust, community enforced trust, but trust based on moral behavior. And trust was more than just that the person would deliver, but they would treat you with respect and with fairness. That even if the contract didn't say that you would be delivered value for value, you would be delivered value for value, because that's the way trust was developed and built over time. And if you did bad things, if you cheated people, or you scammed them, you couldn't do business. Your reputation would prevent you from doing business with everybody else. It'd cut you out.
So you would say that today...
And the second mechanism...
Today we very much have a low trust society.
We have a zero trust society.
Yeah, zero trust.
We're based everything on the idea that contracts can do everything. Yeah, everything's based on contracts, Everything's based on anonymous interactions. We use money as a vehicle, and we can buy and sell and do things that without actually interacting with anyone on a trust basis.
And
but see, that kind of system breaks down.
Yeah, part of the reason that happened is just because we became so prosperous.
Yeah, I think there's probably an intermediary step is that the information required to maintain trust, and once you started scaling up, was too difficult to kind of manage, you know, the information flow, because you know, how do you interact with so many people and maintain, you know, some kind of insight into their trustworthiness. But we're correcting that. And that one thing in terms of trust, we're already starting to see a shift in that regard with these new sharing economy applications like Airbnb. When you rent on Airbnb, you're not only rating the person renting the apartment, gets to rate the person hosting the apartment as well as the person staying in it. So it's a two-way rating system. And that rating that you get that write-up is going to go with you forever in the system. Whenever you do interactions, you know, whenever you rent another apartment or rent another hotel on Airbnb, it's going to travel with you. And the people that wreck apartments or have a blowout party that goes out of control and destroys the place, or you know, they rent a car through Lyft, or you know, they get a Lyft ride or get an Uber ride, and they mess up the car, bug the driver, or beat up the driver, or whatever, or stiff them on the tip. That reputation is going to carry through, and you know what? A lot of people who are doing that right now don't understand. They're still thinking in the anonymous zone, that you can, you know, scammers can go from, you know, interaction to interaction to interaction without any kind of taint, without any kind of repercussion. Well, that's changing. And then and it's because that we have the technology that allows reputations to develop based on action.
But
and
the
those reputations now
the
can,
downside
are starting
of that,
to build, and they will.
The downside of that is anyone could say anything false, could say something false about someone, and people could believe it as the truth.
Yeah, but that is very hard to do when you want to continue to do business. Because what happens is that somebody says something bad about you, you respond in kind on their reputation. And then if multiple people do that to the person that is saying falsities or, you know, lying about you, then they look bad. They actually have problems actually doing what they want to do on the system. You know, it's the volume, it's the number of interactions and positive outcomes or negative outcomes that really matter, and the egregious nature of any one instance. We'll see. I mean, we're going to work out a lot of the kinks in the system, but we're starting to see a return to, you know, reputation, and there's going to be a lot of ways of doing it, but now we have the technology to make that possible. I mean, we went anonymous because, we just didn't have the tech to do it.
And I think the other factor that technology plays in, say, resilient communities is I see people forming communities of, say, like-minded people on the internet, and then that could translate into something in reality.
Oh yeah, that's definitely true. And being able to build that kind of trust and build that kind of relationship online and have that translate into a physical community is a lot of what we're talking about here. There's also the second pillar of this kind of decision making system that made the U.S. so successful was that we focused as a goal on economic independence. And economic independence isn't like what we talk about today as economic independence. Economic independence was a home that paid for itself. That, when you made a dollar outside the home, that dollar was free and clear. Actually, you could invest it or you can save it. You weren't spending it on a mortgage. You know, by 1900, we had 45% of the houses in the United States or households in the United States owned their own home. So we almost had half, and even with a huge immigrant population of people coming in, you know, a huge number of people owned their own home, and the mortgages, to the extent that they actually existed, were less than 5 years. No one had a mortgage over five. And tenant farming was very, very small percentage, mostly in the South. So ownership of a home that was productive, that was a, you know, place where you could build a cottage industry. Now, 30% of the homes had lodgers, had people that were actually paying to stay there, very much kind of like an old style version of Airbnb. You had, you know, farming, or that you produced food at your house, given that 40% of the average household budget was on food, it, you know, that was a big dent in the costs of living. And effectively, you became economically solvent. And it was the goal of the community to help everybody else to do that. I mean, that's why, one thing that became very popular in the United States was the idea of barn raisings, where everyone in the community came together for a young couple and got their barn up. And they weren't just doing it because, you know, it was a nice thing to do. They were doing it because it allowed that couple to become economically viable, economically independent very, very quickly, rather than going into debt to build the barn.
And I think with the dialect with economic independence is when the mainline conservatives talk about it, they just mean being independent from the government, but they're not talking about being genuinely independent as opposed to being independent from the banks or the big corporations.
Oh, yeah, no, the whole thing, we've completely changed the whole way of thinking about economic independence. I mean, and we've been sold on this idea that, you know, it's possible to be economically independent even though you have a 30-year mortgage and that you have, you know, all your money invested in financial instruments or financial products of which you know nothing. I mean, you know, we've been sold a huge bag of lies. I mean, you know, investing in financial products, you know, you buy a stock, you know, the standard person who buys a stock typically doesn't do that well. I mean, I think the average return on investment for the average investor is about 1% a year. And that was during all these boom times. And so we're talking, it's going to decrease from there, is that when they buy a stock, they're profoundly ignorant about that investment. Almost everybody is. Even the stockbrokers who are advocating stuff, only doing it based on a piece of paper shoved in front of them by the a screen shoved in front of them by an analyst inside the firm trying to pump up that stock. They don't know anything about that company. They don't know how it works. They don't know all the managers. They don't know the business. They know nothing about it. Yet they feel strongly enough about that stock to buy it, which is like, effectively, what that is just gambling. And we've been told that gambling, speculating in the markets, is a sound investment. That is something that you should invest your money in. And it's not an investment. It's just pure and simple gambling.
Yeah, I mean, I think
if people are
going to own their own homes at some point, I do think the banking issue has to be seriously addressed.
Well, I mean, the simple way to do banking is just transfer money. But we turn banks into something more. Is that, you know, we turn banks into financial institutions that focus mainly on speculation, on highly leveraged transactions and derivatives. And Citi and Chase and all those, I mean, have big derivatives departments. They're very, very divorced from the reality of what most people need. Huge financial industry, this shadow banking economy is doing stuff that has no productive value.
Are you familiar with
all it is just one big speculation.
Are you familiar with public banking?
With what?
The public banking movement.
Uh, Alternative banking systems and stuff and finance. I'm into this whole, you know, things like crowd financing. It's an alternative to how you invest your money. You're investing it with people, and you're investing it in small amounts. And you're based, you know, we have yet to, like, for instance, in terms of Kickstarter and the like, I mean, we still have yet to build the kind of reputation system that allows you to, you know, pre-qualify or get to know, develop a level of trust with the people that are asking you for investment dollars. And we haven't even worked out any way to kind of, you know, generate any returns on that. Right now it's just, you know, pre-buying a product, but which may or may not be delivered. But a lot of that stuff has to be worked out. And there's also the entire financial system built on Bitcoin. A lot of great work being done there about kind of opening it up and turning it into an amazing kind of backplane to build interesting solutions on. But a lot of this is really going to require, you know, building the reputation systems necessary to make that possible in a way that it, you know, that's other than a scam. I do think that economic independence can be returned just by focusing on trying to become, you know, building a home that doesn't cost you money. And I think you can largely do that now. You know, if you can get a house that doesn't cost you half your income, and then you're on the path to trying to move forward and become economically solvent again. And there's a reason why, you know, Americans were able to buy 500,000 cars a year from Ford way back in 1914, and all the rest of the world, you know, citizens couldn't do it. It's because they were economically independent. They had the wherewithal. They had the means to do it.
In your book,
everybody else was on this treadmill. They didn't have the cut. Yeah, go ahead.
In your book, do you predict that there'll be a return to home ownership, or do you see United States going in a direction where in other parts of the world you have multi-generational families living in one home, or more like communal living? Do you think that will be the trend in the future, or do you think there could be a return to home ownership?
Well, I see home ownership, but with multi-generational. I live in a multi-generational home. So I have kids living here. I have my mother-in-law living here with me. So, you know, I like it that way. But I like having a home, and I like having a home that's productive. And I see the financial benefits of that. As I start to add more and more features to it, more solar production, as solar prices have gone down in terms of costs, and the ability to make money from it is going up. Adding that as a fee. Right now with these existing programs, if you DIY install solar in most states, you could get a return unless, you know, pay it all off in 3 years. And with the 40-year warranty on some of this equipment, you're going to have basically an annuity stream for every year after that. It's a better investment than anything you can do in a pension or stock fund.
You
have control of it, and you know where the money is actually coming.
Are there any barriers that are that? Do you see
what?
Any barriers in the way of people forming resilient communities?
Yeah, sure. There's tons of barriers. We live basically right now in non-productive communities. We turned our homes, you know, largely into, you know, mini English manors with non-productive yards that we spend $40 billion a year maintaining. And, you know, people like their little mini manors. They like these, like, you know, little mansions because they've been sold on that, you know, idea that, you know, a home should just cost you money, that you're speculating on some future value going up. And all of this was built on this idea, you know, in rapid expansion of debt that moved home ownership from that 45% in 1900 up to about 62%. right now. And 62% for all, now everybody has these extensive mortgages and the prices of these homes have gone way, way up, way beyond where they should have been. Price of real estate in the U.S. is far, far higher than it ever should have been because of this debt expansion. All that stands in the way of getting back to economic independence.
Do you think that the economy, things will have to get really bad, like a total economic collapse, for there to start being some serious changes?
No, you know, I'm not looking. See, the thing is, I mean, the kind of change that we need is going to happen at the ground level. There's not going to be a kind of a tweak at the government level or at the big, you know, the national economy level. It's going to be something that occurs on a grassroots level, and it's not going to be led by grassroots organizers. You know, it's going to be by people entrepreneurs and building businesses that make it possible for people to work at home and work in alternative ways. I mean, there's a big push on the left right now to kind of discredit the whole sharing economy. That, you know, they're complaining that, you know, people wouldn't be doing these horrible things like having people stay in their house if they were making more money. And I go, they're not making more money because this economy is stagnating. The kind of bureaucratic economy that relies on credentials, accruing credentials through, you know, going to ever greater amounts of education that have no tangible benefit, in order to secure a bureaucratic job, to invest in a pension and invest in a house that's just costs you money. Well, all of that kind of infrastructure, the way of looking at the world, is just yielding a stagnant economy that's going nowhere. And it allows a, you know, ever smaller group of people to actually game the system to get all the returns.
What we need is address the issue of providing jobs for people. A lot of these are fantastic ideas, but I think the main issue right now is that so many people are unemployed.
Oh yeah, no, most definitely. Is that you've got to rethink the way you actually you think about employment. So the thing that everybody has been pushing for the last 60 years is that the only way to actually move ahead is to get a specific standard job, you know, a full-time job with benefits. And, you know, those jobs are disappearing. And one of the big reasons is, and I didn't have this in the book, but I'll have it in future ones, is that the government was leading the charge on this. Is that the government expansion in the United States got, the bureaucracy grew every year consistently from World War I all the way up through until 2006. And at that point, it started collapsing, and it's been shrinking at all levels, state, local, national. And it's shrinking, and it's occurring not just here, but it's going on globally. Is that the bureaucracy can't support it. It can't continue to expand forever. And all of those jobs that people are looking for are not sustainable in an economy that's increasingly stagnant, increasingly, doesn't produce wealth. It's not gonna get any better. China, is not a solution either. They're just trying to catch up, and they borrowed incredible amounts of money over the last decade in order to try to catch up. And that's gonna, slam them too. This economy has to actually work in a different way. When you think about jobs, is you think about stuff in an incremental level. You've got to add work or income incrementally. Picking up the part-time jobs as a Uber driver and then working on the next thing is getting a place to stay. I mean, for instance, if I was looking for to make any kind of money and I had a little extra cash, I would invest in putting together like an Airstream trailer, one of those old silver ones, if possible, or refurbishing it and putting it in a good location and renting it out over Airbnb. People go around the whole United States looking for places like that to stay. Or even one of those hanging tents, those beautiful you know, one's a suspended tense. There's a, like, tree houses do really, really well in those incremental income methods. And, you know, you're not going to be able to put together a single job. If you get a single, you know, single job, you know, you, it may not last. Or you'll have the benefits stripped away like everybody's seeing. And when you lose it, then you're left with zero. Whereas with all these incremental income streams, if you lose one, you've just lost one of many. Do you know this guy, Shep Holzer?
No.
Okay, so he's one of the early permacultural guys. He's out of Austria. He had a farm built on a hillside in Austria. He was left by his dad, and it was it's basically rocks. And so slowly but surely, he was able to convert it over. And the government was telling him, okay, you have to plant wheat and other standard crops. Here's your choice. And you can only plant it here, and this is how you do it. And he played around with that, and he just didn't like it. So what he did is he ended up planting all sorts of different stuff. And he found ways to actually keep fruit trees in the, 5,000 feet in the Alps and in, very, very cold conditions. He raised fish in the ponds that he created on the hillside. He sold fruit trees, so people could have them in their yards, and then he developed a new method to do that. He has all these different products that he was developing and producing. He had upwards of over 40 products that he sold at different parts of the year, and most of them were niche products that had very, very, discreet audiences that wanted to buy them. And if any one of those went bad or any dozen of those went bad in any given year, it didn't matter. And now the guy's producing about $4 million a year in income from that.
Yeah, I mean, there are ways to produce income. I think one of the barriers to resilient communities is a lot of Americans would associate that kind of living with, say, poverty. And Americans are very much about focused on how they can become wealthy. But I think that's a barrier, is that that they may associate that kind of living with maybe poverty. Do you see that as an issue?
Well, I don't think there's actually one way of doing it. It's like when people complain about people who produce food in their yards. I mean, or have chickens. Say, oh, that's only poor people do that. Well, now every that's changing. I mean, $1 million houses in my area are doing it.
Yeah, same. I mean, same where I live. There's a home near I'm in Santa Barbara, so it's sort of up in the hills. It's probably like a $2 million home, and they have chickens.
Yep. It's a slow but sure change, and so things are changing. There are lots of different ways to build a resilient community. I mean, you can start – it could be a community of the willing. In an existing community, it's a group of people that get together and start to move things forward. To build common spaces, or get together to finance a farm to get going, or a big solar array that makes some extra money, that's a great way to make money now, is to get together with a bunch of people and build a solar array and take advantage of all the benefits that are available to do that. And then you get income for years and years and years off of that. But it's right in your community, and that's one of the big trends in energy right now. It's got to be produced locally, because there's no new power lines going up to carry anything from the desert.
Would you say resilient communities, would they work better in a rural area? Or could there be successful resilient communities in urban areas?
It works as well in either area. I mean, thing is, it's not, a resilient community can be, everybody within this geography in this town is part of it, okay, because you've joined in and you created it and people have bought in, lock, stock, and barrel. But, or else it could be, a community of the willing within that town or within that neighborhood. a group of people, there will be some people that won't participate. And just leave them out. You know, if they don't want to move the ball forward, unlike the nation states of the past that said, you know, okay, if you're within this geography, that we own you. Okay, if you're within the borders of the United States, we own you. If you're within the borders of Mexico, we own you. Well, what we can do now is create a community of the willing, an opt-in community.
And I think there is going to be pressure to suppress this. One example is I know Monsanto has done genetically modified seeds that so they can prevent people from growing their own food.
Oh yeah, no, I mean that's you know, with all the lawsuits and stuff associated with that. Yeah, that's bad news. Getting enough people together. You can mount legal challenges. I mean, imagine a crowd-financed legal challenge to Monsanto in a variety of different places, and trolling for the big civil suit that will bring the massive damages in. That's great stuff. We have to rethink the way we do stuff. Crowdfunding something like that. I mean, many millions of people putting in a couple bucks can. Or $100 or whatever could really sway the tide, but we haven't done it. So there's all sorts of great ways to do it. You know, build communities that can stand up to a lot of pressure. There's lots of different ways to do this. I do think though that focusing on the economic independence is a big deal. You know, once you start to get out of this constant draw, this suck of money that everyone seems to think is okay, things start to change. Granted, there's some certain services you have to get. You know, you have to get internet, you have to get some stuff like that. But you can do so much on so little now. And the focus right now for most people is on quality of life. And if you can do the things you want to do and not scraping by all the time, and quality of life is maintained, then that's the objective.
Yeah, we touched a little bit on the fourth generation warfare and open source warfare, but I think what I'll do is I'd like to have you on again in the future to discuss that more in detail.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay.
That's a whole topic on itself. We could devote. I mean, I was thinking of maybe covering that in this show, but that the two topics deserve their own separate shows. What are some other things in your book that we didn't touch upon? We touched a little bit upon the banking aspect, the mortgages. We touched on people growing their own food.
I made this one really short. It's a booklet. It's focused exclusively on, you know, the three things that underlie the American way. And, I'm not trying to talk, say Americans, are better than everybody else, but we did have something unique. And I think every country has something unique. It's just something cool about the U.S. that we played this special role. And that the three things that I put into the American way was the trust networks, trust in economics. There was the economic independence, and then there was this optimism. But it was an optimism that we could actually make things better. And that's the thing I didn't talk about. But it's why our entrepreneurs, the people who start businesses in the United States, are unlike anywhere else in the world. They just dream big, and they dream about really, truly changing the world. I mean, as much as that's overused, they're pragmatic utopians.
Yeah, your book is an optimistic book. I've noticed among people who are, say, political dissidents, a lot of it is just sort of doom and gloom. Everything is hopeless. We're all fucked.
Yeah. I can do that better than just about anyone.
Yeah.
All right? And now, I can. But it's hard not to you know, if, in order to get around that, you actually have to find something to move towards. And what I found is, you know, there was something great about the past in the U.S. that made us special. And, you know, that made us more economically prosperous than everyone, and was able to lead the rest of the world in tow on this. So, you know, show them the way towards this better way of, more prosperous way of living. And that was a great thing. And, you know, what we've seen since World War II is a lot of the excess, you know, and sour people on that. And getting back to that original thing is good. But, you know, all you hear about right now is how horrible the U.S. is, as if the rest of the world isn't equally as horrible, if not worse. I mean, like, for instance, China, just 50 years ago, I mean, that the same government's in place today, you know, starved 20 million people. You know what I mean? all these governments and nations have done horrible stuff. I think in terms of what the U.S. was able to do in terms of, you know, improving the quality of life for everybody, it's pretty important. And if we can resurrect that, and maybe through the use of new tech and new techniques, that's great. The crowdsourcing and reputation networks and sharing economy stuff.
Do you
focus
see
on economic independence rather than finance?
Resilient communities playing a role in providing social services. This actually does tie into open source warfare, because I know Hezbollah in Lebanon, they provide social services to people that the Lebanese government does not. Do you see resilient communities having that role in the future, say providing healthcare or education?
Oh, sure. I mean, whatever the standards are set by the community, it's better done at a local level or, you know, at a smaller level. I mean, Lebanon is a really small place. Problem comes in is when you have a country the size of the United States and we rely on some kind of central bureaucracy to pull it all off. Resilient communities can play a role and actually do more, much more than an increasingly incompetent and financially strapped government. I think is we got to get those things going. I do think though that, you know, just by changing our focus just a little bit towards these, you know, enduring kind of approaches to making economic decisions, a lot of this just kind of falls out of it. It just makes sense. But you know, I see so many people still focused on, you know, getting the, you know, a tiny apartment in the city and trying to, you know, downsize and get, you know, as if, you know, cutting back on everything is actually going to achieve some beneficial outcome. I mean, the only time you actually where you know the greenest person you know is?
Who?
It's your dead great-great-grandfather. He's not consuming any water, you know, or any energy.
So you're
he's
not
like
suggesting,
super green.
You're not suggesting we should all off ourselves.
Well, I mean, that's effectively when you start to cut back completely and go tiny. I mean, the ultimate tiny house is a coffin. You know what I mean? I mean, it's a negation of life.
Yeah,
personally,
the smallest apartment in New York City that's legally allowed is actually smaller than a jail cell given to well-behaved prisoners in a Midwest prison. I read that somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, cutting back everything is not the approach to focus on. It's actually producing more at the individual level.
And
I produce everything I consume.
So it's a little, not entirely, your idea, it has some overlap, but how is it different than, say, the sort of hippie commune?
Well, no, that's just one methodology of doing it. I'm saying don't drop out or disconnect is connect. I mean, you want to connect, but you want to connect on your own terms. So it's not about, you know, trying to go off the grid. And you see this on the right and on the left. That always ended up in a relative disaster. I mean, if it might have been good for you for a little while to live in a cave, or, you know, but it won't be good for your kids. you know, or the other folks that would get tired of it and leave. And it doesn't improve your position relative to everybody else, because disconnecting makes you vulnerable. What you really want to do is just is gain control of your life, gain control of your economic existence, and connect to all of this system, this network, this global network that's doing so much stuff on your own terms and in a way that's, you know, benefits not just you but everybody else. And you can do that through this kind of economic independence and that kind of approach.
How is the coverage?
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I want to ask you, how has the coverage been so far on your book from the media? Have you gotten reviews and from the major newspapers, like the New York Times?
Pretty light. No, not yet. I mean, I kind of slipped it under the radar, and it is a booklet.
Yeah, your previous.
My previous one took a little while, but. Yeah, I mean, it came out slowly, my first one, but then, you know, after the first 2-3 months, it started picking up. I don't know. This one's different. We'll see. You know, all it takes is somebody to read it and it just starts to click, and then they start translating it to their audiences and like. So I'll just keep on putting out more parts to it. And then I'm going to be writing some stuff about iWAR, kind of open source warfare, but, you know, iWAR like iPhone.
Oh, yeah.
And how individuals can declare war on the world and win. And
a series of booklets.
Yeah. Yeah, I figured that's the way people, I mean, I'm doing it electronically. So it's on Kindle.
Oh, it's all Kindle. There's
so
no
the idea is that, I'm cutting out the print. It's easier to do, and I can do it, you know, relatively costlessly. And there's Kindle readers you can get anywhere. And you can run them in your browser.
And a lot of, because of the internet, like, people have a much shorter attention span, so people are less, they don't want to read this massive book. I think a lot of writers now are shortening everything down.
Yeah, I think everyone's going to sub 50 pages. And why would you want to, you know, who has time to read a 300-page book that's mostly filler?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I want the ideas. But they end up telling, you know, they digress about stories about, I don't know, whatever that went on in their life here and there. And I was like, come on, dude, tell me what you're going to try to tell me. But it's anyway, it's probably a good point to wrap up.
Yeah, so
my voice is giving out.
Yeah, okay. To summarize, so we'll have you on next time. And on our next show, we can cover fourth generation warfare. And the thing you brought up, is it eye warfare?
Yeah, iWAR. It's the same as fourth generation warfare.
We'll talk about that next time. But John Robb, I'd like to check out his website at Global Guerrillas. Is it globalguerrillas.com?
Just put in Global Guerrillas into Google and you'll find it. Or John Robb, JOHNROBB.
So thanks for being
Google
on the show.
I'll pop up.
All
right. My pleasure.
That's all we have for today's
show. Good luck with the show.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time. That's all we-